This is a Power 98.7 podcast. Now we're talking. Subscribe to Power 98.7 podcasts in iTunes or wherever you get your podcasts. There's more on power987.co.za.
Prof, welcome to Power 98.7. Zimkita, same to you. Welcome to Power 98.7. Welcome to Power Perspective. Professor, well, Professor, you there?
Greetings to you, Denzel, and greetings to the listener. I am here, yes. Thank
Absolutely.
You for the welcome. Thank you.
Thank you so much, Prof. Nice hearing your voice there, nice and deep. You should have been in radio. you know, that's when they, you know, when they said, oh, that's such a beautiful voice. That man should be in radio. Zimkita, you too, welcome to Power 98.7.
Thank you so much, Denzel. Good evening to you. Good evening to you, Prof, as well as your listeners as well.
Zimkita, I'm told that you're struggling with load shedding. It's the, you know, it's something South Africans have become used to now. So, you know, we'll deal with that, and I hope that we can deal with it. But we have a conversation over, of course, the next hour or so. Should the proposed policy by Higher Education Minister Bladen Zamandi that South African universities that fail to meet high standards be downgraded in order to transform the country's educational system be passed? So many questions to ask just in that one sentence alone. And so we're going to ask. Let's begin with Professor Makgobe Ramose. And I hope, Ramose, I hope I'm getting it right, right?
Correct, yes. Thank you, Denzel.
Sure. Let's start with where you stand so I have an understanding on the proposed policy in essence as you know it and as you understand it. Where do you stand on it?
One of the first points I would like to make is that I find it odd that at this point in time, the minister is still using a term, university, which is quite obsolete.
Yeah.
It is an old term. It is a term that is actually overtaken by insights from philosophical critique as well as insights found in the sciences, especially in astrophysics.
Okay.
So I'm thinking that actually, to be more precise, the minister should have spoken about pluriversities and not universities. So I will use the term university under protest because I think the correct term is pluriversity to reflect exactly the pan-epistemic character of the institutions that he is referring to.
Pluriversity. So,
pluriversities.
Absolutely.
Yes.
And looking at the word plu, I would assume we are looking at a spectrum of institutions across the board, and we are not just looking at a term of an institution called a university. Am I correct when we talk about plural and pluriversity, the terminology you would then want to use, it would be a sort of broad terminology across the board, looking at institutions broadly then and grouping them together?
Not in the institutional sense,
sure,
but actually in the epistemological sense.
Okay.
That is why I was saying that actually university in concrete practice is actually a pluriversity, but by name it is called a university. This is a contradiction because in the universities, you find different disciplines, you find different knowledge paradigms.
Mm.
So precisely because there are a multiplicity of knowledge paradigms in any given institution, that is a plurality.
Mm.
And so the plurality should reflect what is happening not only in the concrete terms, but also the name itself must reflect that. That is why it is pan-epistemic.
Sure.
Meaning many epistemologies at the same time within a single institution.
Sure.
That's what I mean. I'm not moving so much in the direction of the number of institutions.
No, I got you. I got you. Zimkita, let's bring you into the conversation. Some say it's a contentious document in front of us. You've heard what the prof was talking about when he says pluriversity. If you've got a comment on that one as well, and you know whether you agree in the essence of what the prof was saying. But also I need to understand where you are in aspects to the broad brush strokes of what is before us in this particular policy that has now got, I think, 30 days to be commented on.
Thank you so much, Denzel, and thank you to Prof as well. I agree with Prof, and I think perhaps the draft policy is open for comments, especially in terms of terminology, as Prof has outlined now. So from my understanding, the intention of the proposed policy is to recognize the various kinds of higher education institutions in South Africa. So I think there is room also to comment in terms of recognizing universities from a much broader understanding in terms of knowledge, as Prof has outlined.
And the prof says he will use the terminology university in this particular conversation, but under duress. But that's fine. For the purposes of the conversation, we will then look at it, because the document does talk to universities. So carry on. Yes.
Yes. So one of the points that has been outlined in the policy document is that the intention is also to eliminate the barriers that unduly restrict learners' entry to programs and allow for academic knowledge of past learning, and allowing for more horizontal and vertical mobility in the higher education system. So I think some of the proposed changes, are quite progressive, because I think the intention or the aim is to advance the university space instead of downgrading the university space. So also higher education, or higher education institutions, whether they are public or private, has a purpose, a mandate, and a mission. So each institutional type has an important role to play in ensuring that full range of qualifications from mid to high level skills are developed for the country, to ensure well-educated citizens, right, and capable. So recognizing these colleges into a new framework has little effect on their academic quality and enrollment, right? But this makes it feasible to bring different sorts of institutions closer to the university status than would be otherwise.
Sure.
Right. So, and also, I'm assuming that because we still have a 30-day period, right, for comments to be submitted and so on, more revisions can be made on these and more. So at this moment, I just think the proposal is quite progressive.
The proposal is?
Progressive.
I've got that.
Yeah.
Professor,
I'm sorry for the network.
Sure. No problem. Professor, let's go to you, Professor, and try to understand, as you understand the document in front of you, and I want to then go through various aspects of it as well. What do you think the document tries to do, apart from, the terminology and the proper definitions and categorizing and subdividing? What do you think, when the minister and his people got together to draft something like this and put it in front of people like yourselves, what do you think the aim was?
Well, I see the aim is supposed to be self-evident. It is supposed to be, I would like to underline, supposed to be.
Right.
I am saying this because if one considers that actually the educational paradigm in this country, including the rest of Africa, is actually dominated unjustifiably so,
mm-hmm.
by the paradigm of the Western colonizer.
Sure.
And so the minister is putting the cart before the horse, because
okay.
the central issue is epistemic justice, which is virtually obscured, to put it mildly, uh-huh. in the document. Just virtually obscured, and I'm saying this mildly.
Okay.
From my point of view, this is actually to be highlighted, because there cannot be any advancement, socially or otherwise, if there is no epistemic justice.
Mm.
And there is no epistemic justice at this point in time. And that is what I mean by saying that the cart is actually put before the horse.
Mm.
That's my first point.
Sure.
You see, the second point is related to that. Whether there is movement or not, whether you call it horizontal or vertical within the universities, the point is that even the pedagogic style is that particular style which is shaped and informed by the epistemological paradigm of the colonial conqueror.
Mm.
So actually, if you look at it purely from the perspective of epistemic justice, which is a fundamental issue for me,
mm-hmm.
well, I do not see how one can say this is progressive in the sense that even an element of a pedagogy of the oppressed, we need to see that element quite highlighted in the document,
mm.
an element of a pedagogy of the oppressed, which will advance actually the question of epistemic justice.
Mm.
And as I said mildly, but I mean it seriously, the point is that when we look at this, we see that, well, that which needs to be stated first has received at least studied silence. And that is problematical for me.
Mm.
Now, I don't know if I may continue.
No, continue. Please continue.
All right. Okay, so I have touched the pedagogy.
Yes.
And I am saying that when we move from the pedagogy to a very strange wording, well, I call it strange wording, but it is supposed to be normal.
Mm.
You know, high standards, whose high standards? You see, as soon as we pose the question, whose high standards, then we return back to the question of epistemic justice.
Mm.
So when you say those who do not meet the high standards, whose high standards? Because these were not even democratically decided. An element of democracy must be present even in an educational system.
Mm.
And in this case, we have a big problem of democratization of education, precisely because the dominance of the epistemological paradigm of the conqueror is standing in the way of this.
Mm.
Okay?
Sure.
So, you know, it's nice language to say high standards, but it is not ethical language. It's very nice, but it is ethically dubious. And so we don't need that. We must be clear and precise. We must see education in this country in its historical context and weigh it up from an ethical perspective. And that's where not only philosophy comes in, but also where common sense comes in.
Professor, then I need to ask you, are you surprised then that a document of this nature then, which would sometimes not consider, and a lot of the critique that's been laid against it suggests that, you know, these kind of conversations have been had before, they have failed before. This type of conversation that's in the policy document have been had before, they have failed before, because they don't understand the historical context, you know, of where Black particular universities come from and how they have developed over time. And white institutions in this country have, you know, benefited from the past, as you talk about it, and you talk about, you know, the pedagogy of the oppressed. So understanding all of that, do you think, or are you surprised that a document like this actually is up for conversation and is put up for comment, considering actually where we do come from in our historical context? And also, you know, one would assume that, you know, the ANC and or someone like, you know, the minister would assume and understand the context then of from which we come. Would you be surprised then that suddenly here is a document that, you know, you're talking about also dominated by the West, influenced by the West?
Well, I am not surprised, really. Mm-hmm. First, because it is a formality to submit documents of this nature for public comment. So from that point of view, I'm not surprised.
Sure, that is a standard, and that's what the department should and would do, yes.
Precisely. Whether or not it was discussing this specific issue, it would still be obliged in formal terms.
Absolutely.
To do what it is doing now.
Yes.
So that is no matter for surprise. The content becomes the issue of surprise.
Yeah. Mm. And I'm specifically talking to the content and the context that comes with that.
Precisely. So when we get into that, it is very true that these issues, including the ones I'm raising now, and some that I will raise if time permits.
Sure.
These issues have been raised time and again. Mm. We don't need to be, you know, standing, singing the same song many times over.
Mm.
We have to move beyond that song. And so it is a surprise that in terms of content, there is no movement beyond that song. And that is the reason why it prompts reactions like mine.
Mm.
These reactions should actually be an assessment of the progress made since the original critiques were made. Now, this from this point of view, you know, this is idle repetition, as I sometimes mark our students. I just put in the margin, this is idle repetition.
Mm.
And this is precisely what it is.
Idle repetition.
Mm. We really have heard and read about this time and time again. We need to move at least one step forward.
Mm.
Professor, you see, because as it stands,
yeah,
this movement, you know, moving this along this as they propose. You simply were doing a number of things. Let me mention one of them.
Sure.
One of the things that you're doing is simply the transference of class consciousness.
Mm.
But this time you transfer it into science and the academia.
Mm.
Yeah. Now, this is a problem, especially if one links this point to what we have now in the educational system under the same minister, the NRF rating.
Mm.
That is one evidence of the promotion of class consciousness in academia.
Sure.
And so we now academia is not in a vacuum. It is concrete. So what we see then is, well, when you have this class consciousness in its two aspects, the social and the academic side of it, what do you produce? What do you produce socially? Divisions according to class, divisions according to rank, and in the academia, you quite often, and that's experience over the years that I have had in this country, you then have, you know, cognitive dominance. I know it all because I'm professor. You listen to me. I think that is quite problematical. It has been a problem. It continues to be a problem. And so to solve that in part, I must say, to solve that in part, this promotion of class consciousness in academia must really be urgently reviewed. Urgently reviewed. Because even the objectivity and the standards that are being used to rank this and that academic are still subject to question.
This is Power 98.7. It is Power Perspective. My name is Denzel Taylor. 16th of August. It is Tuesday. I am with you until midnight. That studio line to call 0861987000 or WhatsApp number 0833037093. On Twitter, we are at PowerFM987. Our show hashtag is Power Perspective. On Facebook, we are Power FM Frequencies in and around Gauteng. I told you that before the news. I'll tell you that now. Pretoria, Johannesburg, 98.7. Joburg South and the West Rand, 103.6. In Vereeniging, we are on 104.4. East Rand and Ekurhuleni, 107.2. And we are 889 on the DSTV audio channel Bouquet. Online streaming is at www.powerfm.co.za. In Rustenburg, we are on 98.7. We are having a conversation, of course. Should the proposed policy by Higher Education Minister Bladen Zamandi that South African universities that fail to meet high standards, and of course, Professor Magobe Ramose talking about whose standards, and when we talk about who failed to meet high standards, whose standards are those? And he would ask that particular question, be downgraded in order to transform the country's educational system. And that transformation is also something that Professor Magobe Ramose was talking about. Zimkita, I'm going to come to you in a second, but I have to go to Advocate Sipho Mantula. Advocate, the conversation, so far, it's a learning curve even for me here, sitting with Zimkita and sitting with Prof. Magobe, learning things all the time. So what's your take on the conversation so far?
Denzel, good evening, and Jambo Africa. I think you are relating, Denzel, and give thanks for bringing Tate Ramos to share with us what has been, like he has said, ideal repetition. And I think when he spoke about the knowledge justice, which is epistemic justice, most of the liberation movements then have failed since the liberation movements of 1960s or 1963. And I've been forced, when I look at that policy, Denzel, talking about producing, researching knowledge, contributing to the NDP international scholarship, where is the community scholarship here? And how do you sustain the so-called peer-reviewed academic journals, Denzel, that doesn't speak to the challenges of our own people? But finally, Denzel, there are two African scholars that I think Professor Ramose will recall that when they talk about what then is the purpose of education. John Henry Clark said the purpose of education is to teach a student or a scholar to be a handler of power. Now, in this instance, Denzel, is it a white power or a black power? And finally, 73 years ago, Robert Mangalisa Sosobuko, when he spoke at the University of Port Hare in 1949, Denzel, he posed this question, which I think is relevant to your debate on this policy. He asked, when he said, are we to understand that, I mean, by that, an African college or university guided, as in the present, should be guided by European thought and strongly influenced by European staff.
Mm.
So if one can look, Denzel, you have 26 universities in this country that if you ask yourself, if you have a national crisis in this country, whether it is community violence, is COVID-19, is corruption, then you ask yourself, what knowledge are they bringing? If we are failing to even fund those so-called disadvantaged black universities.
Mm.
And hence, I'm saying to you, what are we having, what Professor Sabelo Kacheni Ndlovu will say, that in Africa, you don't have an African university. You have universities in Africa, but you don't have an African university.
Mm.
Meaning, we have a Western knowledge that has parachuted itself. And when you talk of policies, whether it's the policy that you have been given 30 days, Prof will tell you, even for a student to do a research work, it will take a year. So if you give a policy on an education level and you give it 30 days, Denzel, does it make sense? Is it common to everyone? If you have delayed, even when the young people of 2015 said that we need an African decolonial education system, and only now you said universities must look either they are qualified to be colleges. So, like Prof said, it's a class conscious. The issue of ratings, the issues of African scholars when they do university exchange programs, they always go to Europe, Denzel. None of them will tell you he wants to go to Uganda, Addis Ababa, Lesotho, Namibia, Zimbabwe. They all want to go to European universities.
And in essence, isn't
that challenge?
Isn't it, Prof, advocate that you know, when we talk about universities that would have to up their standards and or, you know, be downgraded, in essence, we're talking about universities like Fort Hare and the University of the Western Cape, which would in essence take us back to kind of an apartheid system where Fort Hare, for example, used to be, I think, was it under Rhodes and mentorship under Rhodes? Yeah. And so we go back to a process where one university has to oversee another until they come up to the standards. And like the prof says, you know, whose particular standards are we then engaging on? So you would find in essence that it is mainly the disadvantaged universities or institutions that we're talking about again.
Correct, Denzel. I think you are raising well, but let's engage prof and hear his views on this issue of international scholarship vis-a-vis community knowledge. Because the higher education, Denzel, doesn't speak of community-based research. They are now talking of community-engaged scholarship. What is this scholarship? Are we selling our soul to the highest bidder?
Advocate, thank you so much for the call. Advocate Mantula, of course, he is in Roodepoort. Prof. Makgobe Ramose, I'm going to come back to you. It seems as though, you know, load shedding is dealing with our brother there, Zimkita, on the other side, Manyana. We're trying to get him back, Zimkita Manyana. But let's go back to you, Prof. Makgobe. On the stuff that you heard there, the advocate talking about, and the questions that he's particularly put to you as well, what would your commentary be on before we start talking about the nitty-gritty of the policy as well?
Thank you. And I'm also in the dark, but I recharged before, so if my...
oh, my word.
So if my battery dies, we have an alternative with your colleague, if my battery dies.
Sure.
Yeah, but yeah. Well, thanks for the input of Advocate
Mantula there, yes.
Yes, indeed. I very much appreciate that. I just want to make one preliminary point, which is that actually even the description of these universities as HDUs, historically disadvantaged, the disadvantaged part is problematical because it is elusive, it is evasive, it is dodging the history. You know, if I am taller than you and we must take something from a cupboard very high up, surely I will pick it up and you will need a ladder or some support, okay? So you have a disadvantage. And if I'm still tall and we walk together in heavy lightning, you have an advantage and I don't have.
Mm.
So these advantages tend to be more or less natural.
Mm.
In this case, we are not speaking about anything natural.
Mm.
We are speaking about a human-made arrangement.
Yes.
So it was a deliberate deprivation of the right to education. So there is no disadvantage about it. And this disadvantage should please just be removed, just as one needs to remove this whole question. It's a question of education, so I may mention it. You know, we talk the language of big basic income grant. What is that really? Especially for people who want to go to Europe, as the advocate said. People go to Europe to learn. Well, I was there teaching there as well. One of the things I learned is that the social welfare states describe this as bestaans minimum recht. You know, it's a basic subsistence right. It is not a grant.
Mm.
A grant can be offered one day, tomorrow you withdraw it.
Mm.
So it's a matter of education again. You know, language plays a role.
And the word grant is almost a demeaning sort of word also.
Yes, indeed. You know, in Northern Sotho, when I listen to Tobela FM, for example, they refer to it correctly. Mpiwa fela. So if I give you just, I can decide not to give you just. But if it is a right, it's a different issue.
Sure.
We can debate your right to deprive me of my right. So, you know, it is not so that we can take language easy. We must be very much careful about the type of language we use, the meaning it has, and the impact it has on society.
Sure. Prof,
and that is why I was speaking the language of the pedagogy of the oppressed.
Yes. Prof, while we're on this point, what language would you use where people normally use the terminology of historically disadvantaged? Because you've put it in context, what would the correct terminology be so that, you know, even in the historical context, it is understood?
It should really stand as historically rights denied universities.
So that people understand. Yes, people understand precisely. It immediately.
Exactly, there should be no cover ups and sweeteners of a bitter pill. We don't need a sweetener. Things must be clear and straight. And so, in this case, It is evasive to disadvantage. Was it natural? No. Even if the university were so-called black universities there, geographically they were in the bush, okay? Epistemologically, they were not in the bush. Because it was the epistemology of the conqueror which dominated and still dominates those universities. My second point is,
Prof, when you say, Prof, before you move on, Prof, to your second point, when you say and still dominates those universities, let me understand what you suggest that means. When you say dominated those universities and still dominates those universities, please give me clarity on that one.
Thank you. The point I'm making is that you find universities teaching, for example, John Locke, Thomas Hobbes, this one, Adam Smith, this one and that one. You never hear anything in the economic and management sciences, for example, about the meaning of Sisheho or Ingolobani Yesizwe. You don't hear anything serious about the meaning of cattle as a symbol and the reality of wealth. And I would like to come to that as part of the pedagogy of the oppressed. So this is why don't we hear that in mathematics? You you are told our children don't understand, don't know mathematics at all. They have difficulties.
Mm.
When you check the curricula of most universities, if they ever do, you will find that from honors, they have what is called ethno-mathematics.
Mm.
That is where, if you are lucky, you will find the works of Paulus Gerdes, who died in 2012. He specialized in studying this so-called ethno-mathematics. And I'm telling you, his texts are such that if we were to explain a circle by asking a little kid from the rural areas, have you ever seen a rondavel?
Mm.
They will understand a lot of mathematics.
Absolutely.
Now, to
because that would symbolize when, that would symbolize for them in real terms what a circle was.
Precisely. Mm. So why wait for honors when so many they have it every day?
Mm.
Their grannies are sitting there in Boom Street using beads of different colors to do this and that and that. All kinds of triangles, this and that, circles. Don't they see their grannies do that?
Mm.
Can't they ask them, go watch your granny and bring a circle? It will bring a circle.
Mm.
It will bring a triangle. So why make these things mysterious and tell our children, no, these are very difficult things for you? Incidentally, I studied the history of art and we are following Etruscan art. You find that explanations of these paintings and whatever you have go exactly in the same direction as that given by Paulus Gerdes.
Mm.
How can our children not count? If they play again, I listen to Tobela FM.
Mm-hmm.
There you hear very clearly and distinctly description of traditional games like Murabarab. Children can learn to count, and they count every day when they play, even in the rural areas.
Mm.
Why don't bring this at that early stage in the textbooks? Can you see what I mean by systemic justice?
So we are. So in essence, Prof, what you are saying then is we're failing right at the beginning. Before we even engage the high level conversations that Bladen Zamande is bringing about whose standard and why, you know, universities need to go through this rigorous now new challenge, you're suggesting that in essence, right at the beginning of the conversation already, we're failing.
Exactly, because I heard our my friend and advocate friend saying that Gacheni said this and that about that there are no African universities but universities in Africa. Even long before him and even long before me in my writings, for example, Ali Mazrui had it and he used the expression, universities in Africa are simple transmission belts of education from the West.
Mm. Transmission you belts see? Of education from the West.
Precisely.
Mm.
So they're just transmission belts. We don't have African universities. And yet here is a minister telling us that we must now be busy ranking and upgrading and downgrading other universities. No point.
Sure.
No
then,
point.
Then, Prof, the question then, other than change the minister and replace him with somebody who might, you know, think differently, what do we need to also change so that the universities, in essence, not African universities, but universities in Africa, begin then to understand the kind of language you're talking about. If for no other reason but you know to change, what needs to be done?
A lot of things. One of which is to address what the advocate said.
Mm.
People don't want what they want to be international. And the word international is profuse in the document before us. You see, we must remember that Africa including this geographic entity called South Africa. There were no people. That's why it is called South Africa. You see, there were no human beings. It was only the southern region of Africa. So this South Africa that is called South Africa actually became international from the moment of Romanus Pontifex in 1435. It became even more international in 1652. So what international are you looking at? Because it was already internationalized by these two events. What more do you want? Do you want to go study in Harvard or in Louvain, where I studied, and then come and tell people I studied in Oxford, I studied in Harvard? You're leaving the Harvard here, and I think the advocate is precisely correct. We must focus on issues of justice in the community, at the community level. Now, if I must give you one example, if you allow me.
No, please do. Please do.
Yes. You know, 51 years ago, that is half a century ago, when he took over as president of the United States, Kennedy said the following. Well, he didn't say I didn't hear him, but he wrote it. So what he wrote was, a man holds in his mortal hands the power to abolish all forms, please note, he writes, all forms of human poverty and all forms of human life. Now, this is 51 years ago. The world, if we wanted to, at that time, and I'm sure the president was not lying. I want to underline that. President Kennedy did not lie when he declared that there is power to abolish all forms of human poverty. It is available. Now, if that was true, why is it that in the intervening period, we got more and more poor people, and these were concentrated in the continent of Africa? Now, in 2021, we read again from the United States that actually the 2008-2009 economic crash, you remember that?
Yes.
The total bailout of the bank has now been estimated at 29 trillion. I'm reading from a text.
Sure.
The UN Food and Agriculture Organization estimates that to wipe up global hunger would cost 30 to 60 billion per year. So if we had not spent this on bailing out the banks, we could have eliminated hunger for over 500 years. How many people are hungry now? Now, this is the pedagogy of the oppressed. This is what we need to ask, because we could half a century ago feed everybody else. Now we have decided to feed the banks with money that could feed humanity for 500 years.
Sure.
So what is the minister talking about? Why should we be bothered about high standards policy, this and that? We will be bothered about that for as long as we are the captives of the epistemology of the colonial conqueror. For as long as we remain captives, yes, we will talk this language of the document. But if we really speak from the perspective of the pedagogy of the oppressed, then we will ask different questions, because epistemic justice is a central issue. Standards are part of the problem and not solution to the problem as they stand now.
Professor, let's pause there a second and go to two people who've been holding on to speak to you. Mziwanda in Centurion.
Hi, sir. How are you?
I'm good, man. How are you?
Good. I will just make my comments very short and very quick.
Sure.
I just wanted to disagree with Prof a little bit with regards to the statement he made that universities like University of Fort Hare, maybe others, and that are deemed as previously disadvantaged universities. I think he said they were not disadvantaged, but certain rights were taken away from the university or the institutions. We just need to call a spoon a spoon. Those universities are still, even to this date, disadvantaged. I'm a product of the University of Fort Hare, the University of Zululand, and you mentioned a lot. And the governing party is still failing to correct that. I'm with the other institution now that is more privileged, even to this date. I do not understand why the Minister of Higher Learning, the institution, Higher Learning and Training, is failing to flesh this problem out so that universities like Fort Hare do not end up now being seen as, even to this date, and under administration of the other university that has been privileged for a long time, like University of Rhodes University.
He's gone. There he's gone. Lennox in Sasselburg. Lennox?
Good evening, Denzel, and good evening to Professor Ramos as well.
Good evening, Lennox.
Yes. Thank you for bringing him through to come and give us, you know, a free
a free lecture. Absolutely. We don't even have to pay for it.
Oh, precisely. Yeah, that's very nice of you. Look, I am listening to the professor, and he's talking a lot of good content, and he's putting a lot of things, you know, in very good Afro context. But, you know, meanwhile, we're looking at, you know, basing our university system curricula and whatnot, you know, from an African perspective. I think the one thing that we surely should be looking at in terms of the ethics that would purportedly be looked at by the minister would be obviously that of, you know, the progressive world, to speak. And reasons are so many. I mean, for me, it would be progressive benchmarking, you know, in terms of the governance systems and economics that are actually working up to that of our own. And surely it's a quest for competitiveness, you know, to foot up to the level of everybody else in the developed world. But then, you know, having to chase in the meantime, after making sure that we get a consummate Afro-based university redesign kind of a system, is actually going to set us a bit back. But though, my suggestion would be it be a long-term thing so that it can be consummate enough, you know, to a level that it can help us address the kind of problems that we have in the continent today. But then for most of the world, I mean, look at China, for instance. I mean, the education system they're using there, it's not entirely Chinese. It's got a mixture of everything. But I think maybe if I just nip it on that and to hear how the professor is going to respond. Thank you so much.
Thanks, Lennox. Let's go back to the professor. Professor, two comments there. Maybe you want to deal with them before we move on.
Thank you, Dan. Sure. Thank you. Yes, I think we're moving in the same direction, more or less, but not with the same kind of emphasis as far as both speakers are concerned. And so I welcome their comments, and I would like to add on to those comments.
Please do.
One of the things I want to add is precisely what I read from the two texts, that actually one of the things that has propelled the minister to actually come with this and previous documents was precisely the question of money. Now, we have seen how money can be spent over half a century. It can be spent on a lot of things except human well-being.
Prof, explain the essence of the money in the document for us.
The essence of the money is this will mean that if we follow this, there will be some kind of savings.
Okay.
Right. Mm. Now, savings for whom?
Mm.
Again, from the point of view of the pedagogy of the oppressed, I want to put this forward. I'm happy to say, let me start with this preliminary observation, that I am happy to note that belatedly, the ANC is now thinking about wealth tax.
Yeah.
We know for sure that historically speaking, wealth accumulated by some of the people living with us, to be more precise, the posterity of the colonial conqueror. There is money. We read so many books and texts about money being galore in this country.
Mm.
Lots of money. But those who have it want to keep it to themselves. They don't want to use it for human well-being, like we have seen that over half a century, human well-being was forgotten.
Mm.
Now, I am saying that if, for example, economics departments here were really to focus on the issue of wealth tax, not as a kind of academic nicety, but precisely as a question of justice to promote epistemic justice.
Mm.
So those who have wealth, which we know was not justly acquired, must be taxed. We no longer need weapons.
Mm.
I mean, they did not tax us in the past. What they did was to put gradations. Whites will earn so much. Colors will earn so much. Indians so much. And what we were called at the time, Bantu, will earn so much.
Mm.
Well, that was more than direct taxation and diminution of wages and salaries for the benefit of others.
Mm.
So justice is quite clear in this issue. Wealth tax is an ethical imperative for this country. We don't have to be rushing to the World Bank or whatever international financial institution.
The money is right here.
The money is right here.
The money is right here.
Why not have the courage? Why not have the courage? Education is meant to take you out of so-called darkness. Why do we prefer to remain in the dark?
Mm.
No.
Isn't there a threat? Isn't there a threat? And I know we're deviating a little bit off the thing. Isn't there a threat if you do want to begin to impose wealth tax that people would begin to move those monies that we have agreed that the money is right here?
Well, you know what? There is such a thing called law, and it is their law.
Mm.
We mustn't forget that there is such a thing called law. They have already made arrangements, even so-called international arrangements. So, you know, you tighten the law. Once you do this, you know that it is multifaceted. That is why I was talking the language of pan-epistemic knowledge. People should know what psychological impact this will have. François Hollande in France, when he was president of France, also had some taxation of sorts. And one of the wealthy people in France decided to move. He even changed his nationality from French to Belgian citizenship. Do you think he had it better there?
Mm.
No. We live in one planet. They have to recognize this is the livable planet we have. And we must be in a position to live together in peace. We don't need weapons today. We need intellectual weapons to get things right.
Mm.
And so, like they were using their intelligence according to Jan Spark's inspiration, we can also use our intelligence and say, now we can think of wealth tax in terms of the spirit of Seshego and Inoroban Yesizwe. We can think of it in those terms. And those who don't want are free to go. But they know that when they go out, the rand because of currency conversions will be so weak that they will be poor almost the next day. So they will be bound to stay here.
Mm.
Let's not be, you know, let's open our eyes.
Mm.
Just let's open our eyes and have the courage. So let this belated question of wealth tax be urgently treated as a matter of ethical imperative. It is an urgent issue.
Professor,
people have died over half a century now, when we can feed people for 500 years from now. People can be fed for 500 years globally. No, I mean, you know, the pedagogy of the oppressed is fundamentally ethical, and it is in quest of justice, epistemic and social justice. You can't have one at the expense of the other. They must run concurrently, and this is the issue here.
Sure. Prof, hold on for me. I've got two people who really want to engage in the conversation as well. Solly and Leondale. Solly?
Denzel, how are you?
I'm good, Chief. How are you, Brur?
And the professor, thanks for making me privileged to speak to the professor.
Absolutely, Brur.
I've got a limited education. But I want to say this, man. The professor is talking about the money that salvage the banks instead of feeding the people for 500 years, talking about the money.
Mm.
But according to me, before even we talk about money, how we manage our affairs, I think it is also contributing in terms of putting us into deep poverty. Because if you look at the food that we don't finish on our plates in the restaurant throughout the country in one day, if it was managed well, I think it could end up in the stomach of the hungry people in our household. In my house, if people, they eat, I become happy. But if I see food goes to the dustbin because of it was not properly managed, I fight with them to say that I drive to the supermarket, walk the aisles, buy food, and then it goes into the pot. I use electricity. At the end of the day, it goes to the dustbin. It means that I've wasted my image. So in short, what I'm trying to say, if this happens into my house and then multiplied by all the households that we have in the country, the supermarkets, the expired food that they throw away, and so on and so on. Before we even talk about money, how we manage food, I think it is also the cause why some of the people, they go hungry.
Thanks,
but I want to give the professor the homework to say that to his students, that he suggests to others that they do thesis on this thing of how we manage food in terms of how the restaurants, the supermarkets, and so on can manage it better,
Sully,
so that it ends in the stomachs of the people.
Solly and Leondale, thank you. Temba in Benoni. Temba?
Yes, hi. Good evening, Denzel, and good evening to the prof.
Sure, man.
Well, I'd like to sound very radical to the prof. I've got two quick questions. Firstly, what if, with all what the prof has said, that doesn't enjoy any popular support, what he terms as the pedagogy of the oppressor, and as a result, everyone supports the same pedagogy that professor claims that, you know, is not popular. What would be professor's views on that? As a result, people would like to even to go to these European universities as opposed to going to African university. Then the second question is, if professor claims that all what he says enjoys support, why during COVID, you know, we're all listening to the foreign science and the African academics were quiet. We are all submitting to all what they were telling us. Where were they? What is it that they produce as an alternative knowledge? And lastly, quickly, how many academics in Africa that are highly rated, that they can stand on their own and challenge the Western academics or scientists?
Temba, let's go back to the prof then. Prof, a couple of questions there to you as we begin to round up the conversation, Professor.
Thank you. Thank you. I thanks for the questions from the two questioners.
Sure.
The first one, I think I on food management.
Yes.
You know, I think that two points can be made. I agree with you that lots of food is actually being thrown away unnecessarily. So if people can really put the required quantity in their plates, a lot of food could be saved. I agree. And I agree also, I would like to refer the first speaker to a little book which is very important called Conversations with Ogotomeli. There you will see a very important sentence. The sentence is that in Africa, food is never thrown away. Now, I want to contrast that with what happens as far as the economic system that prevails is concerned. The food that remains in your Woolworths or whatever, sometimes I go down, I watch the time, and when the shops are about to close, they sell food at less price because they want the money. So they sell it at less price than during the day. And when they close and the food is still there, well, either they are going to throw it away or they are going to give it to the animals. Now, I have noticed quite recently that some of our brothers in the nearby malls here where I live actually go the next day. They buy that food before it is actually thrown away. And they have their little shops where they sell the same
food. They resell it.
They resell it. You see, so this tells us something, that the one who actually had the power to give did not want to give. They wanted to throw the food away.
Yes.
They didn't.
That was their first option.
That is their first and most important option. And this is the option that prevails across the globe in terms of this principle. If it did not prevail, we would not be talking the language as we speak, the language, especially in Western Europe, the language of the Butter Mountain and the Milk Lake. You see, they have an oversupply, and if the surplus is too much, who do they feed? The ocean instead of human beings. Why do they do that? Because they want to maintain the prices in the economy. So it's either you buy or you die. Either you buy or you die.
As simple
now,
as that.
This is seriously an African. We know that in Africa we talk the language of fita komo tsware moto, but there it's the opposite. You rather let the human being die and grab wealth and money as tenaciously as you can.
Because you also don't want to influence the price, because you don't want to drop the price. By destroying it, you would maintain the price.
Denzel, you're dead right. You're dead right. And so you see that the logic is different. So when you go into economic and management sciences here, and you don't find this basic ethical contradiction in economic discourses, then you have to ask yourself, what is happening? Do we really have to wait for Muhammad Yunus? You know, he was a professor. He got his degree international again. He left his home country, Pakistan, went to study in the U.S., got a doctoral degree in economics, went back to his homeland, taught in the university, and decided this is not going to solve the poverty problem in my country. So he decided to leave that and start from scratch with his student. And you can check that for yourself in his book, Banker to the Poor. He has a very sound critique of the logic and the intention of banking according to the Western philosophy of money. Now, how many faculties or colleges of economic and management sciences, first of all, teach philosophy of money? I've never seen one anyway, even overseas where I was teaching. I was curious to check. I haven't seen a special item, philosophy of money. I didn't see that. I'm still curious. And so, because this is not happening, well, only one, like you rightly said, you want to maintain the prices, so let people die and let the prices go. What is that? That then you will get a situation that I just described, that you are going to wait for another half a century talking the same language. And that is why I was saying this document of the minister is putting the cart before the horse. We have heard it. We have seen it all. Our two brothers are confirming this, you know? Well, as far as the second speaker is concerned, when we talk the language of, well, where were the African scientists, this and that, you still take us back to whose science, one. Number two, this science is protected and owned jealously. Those who own it protect and defend it because they have an interest in subordinating you and having you in a position of subordinated dependency.
Eliminating you from the eliminating you from the conversation.
Precisely. All our brother has to check. It's Michel Foucault. I see that sometimes students pronounce it as Foucault. It's fine. We don't have to speak French. They don't speak our language. But it's Michel Foucault. Okay. Now, the power of politics in the control and manipulation of knowledge is not an abstract question. It's a concrete question. And to that, our brother has to add intelligence services. They are not asleep. They make sure that the plans that you make, that's why they want you to study overseas. When they were here before, it was easy. Now the so-called independence, which is only political, has made it difficult for them. So they invite you to study there, but you must tell them about your own things here. You know nothing about their things. So they will take care of their knowledge there. Tell us about you so that we can see where we are missing points of controlling you.
So, tell us about you.
Yes, tell us about you. That is how it goes. It is tell us about you and we will know how to handle you. What does it matter if we give you $5,000 per year to study you? I mean, the return for that is much, much more. The return is much more. So knowledge, politics, and power have an interrelationship, my brother Temba. Don't forget that. There is serious power politics, and there is also the intelligence aspect to it.
Sure.
Do remember that. If you have forgotten how Patrice Lumumba died, I want to remind you that that is precisely one of the incidents, just one of the incidents which will tell you that actually intelligence services play a crucial role in shaping the direction not only of one country in Africa, but all the countries in Africa, including those outside of Africa, like Latin America, for example, Guatemala. So please, let's not read these things from the perspective of the colonial conqueror only. For sure, we have to engage in dialogue with them. That is definite. There is no way we can avoid dialogue with them. But it must be critical dialogue proceeding from the point of the pedagogy of the oppressed.
Professor, yes, to end the conversation, Professor, going back to, of course, the policy proposed, idle repetition is what you called it previously, which you say when you mark, you know, the scripts of your students, you put in the sideline there, idle repetition. That's it. Expand on that as we end the show.
Well, the points I have made, I wish to see highlighted not in this document, but in a fresh document that will show that we want to move away from documents like this. We would like to move out of epistemic captivity. We want to move out of the prison of epistemological, constrictions. We want to move. It must be a document of the oppressed, not the oppressor, the oppressed actually resisting oppression and showing that this resistance actually means there is no need, serious need, to talk the language of downgrading those who. No, let us talk epistemic justice and let us see what epistemic justice, given the points that not only me, but all those who spoke in this program, given those points that have been made, what kind of document will come out of that? You see, we must remember that Van Zylslaverd wrote a book way back, and the title is The Last White Parliament. Well, the title was partly correct. The parliament was the last one in terms of having only white faces in that building. But the parliament was the continuation of white epistemology. That we must not forget. And it is still the case today.
Sure.
So that is where the title. Now, this is what I mean by let us not be befuddled by strange things.
Professor, hold, yes. Professor, hold that thought. Professor, I want to go to Benny quickly before we engage. Benny, you're in Pretoria Central.
Yeah, how are you?
I'm good, Benny. How are you?
I think the professor is dodgy. The guy asked him, the last caller, what are they doing, these black professors? They come on radio and talk about all this. The Africa, as it is now, it can't develop, but it's got black professors. What are they doing? What are they writing? What are they doing progressive?
Sure. Benny, I'm going to go back. Professor, you want to end the conversation for me on that?
I'm advising the last speaker.
Yes.
To please, he says, what are they writing? I suspect if he Googles me and all those who spoke, if they are on Google, he will see that we are writing, but I am sure that we are being resistant. One of the prominent people who resist us, and we challenge him, we are not even afraid. One of the prominent people is on television, a certain judge, Dennis Davis. He is challenging us because, according to him, what we are arguing can destroy, can make the legal system a bit of a problem. So that means we are doing something. If they don't react the way he does, it means we are not doing anything. The minute fear is instilled in them, my brother, you must know that they are thinking that something is happening. So something is happening. Please Google us and you will see that we mean what we say in action.
Sure.
We mean what we say in action.
Professor Mohobe Ramosa, thank you so much, sir, for joining me here tonight.
Thank you very much, Denzel, for the invitation. And I thank everybody who participated in this. Many thanks to you all.
Thank you. That's Professor Mohobe Ramosa, of course, Professor of Philosophy from the University of Pretoria.
You've been listening to a Power 98.7 podcast. For more podcasts, visit power987.co.za or subscribe wherever you get your podcasts.